Let's turn to Exodus chapter 20, and I don't think we're going to get beyond this chapter in this session. It, in many respects, could be considered one of the most significant chapters in the Old Testament, only because it is here that we first are introduced to the Ten Commandments. Now, that's how we know these expressions. We call them the Ten Commandments. The Jews actually called them the Ten Words. Either the Latin or the Greek, I'm not sure which it is. I think it must be the Greek for the Ten Words is Decalogue. Is that Greek or is that Latin? Deca? That must be Latin, huh? Yeah, Decapolis was Latin, okay. Decalogue, then, would be Latin for the Ten Words. And so the Ten Commandments are sometimes called the Decalogue, the Ten Words. And, of course, many people consider the Ten Commandments to be the essence of the whole Old Testament. Now, Jesus didn't say so. In fact, when he was asked what the essence of the Old Testament was, he picked two commandments. Neither of them are found in the Ten Commandments. You know, the Jews came to him and said, which is the great commandment? And they thought he'd pick one of the ten. He didn't pick any of them. He said, well, the great commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. That's from Deuteronomy 6:4. It's not from the Ten Commandments. He said, there's another one, which also isn't from the Ten Commandments, which is you shall love your neighbors yourself. That's from Leviticus. However, you'll find, as we study the Ten Commandments, that Jesus was quite correct in saying, upon these two hang all the law and the prophets. Now, what he meant by that is all the law, including the Ten Commandments, is contained in those two statements. Love God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and love your neighbors yourself. You'll find that the first four commandments have reference to how you revere God and love God. The last six commandments have to do with how you love your fellow man. And it's very clear that a person who loves God with all his heart, with all his soul, and all his mind will not violate any of the first four commandments. And a person who loves his neighbor as himself will not violate the other six. And so Jesus was quite correct. Instead of picking out one of the ten, which would have immediately set one commandment above the other nine, he said, well, I've got two, really, and they're not even from the Ten Commandments, but they encompass the whole thought and the whole spirit of the Ten Commandments. And if a person would just love God as he should and love his neighbor as he should, then the whole law would be fulfilled in his life. Now, that's what we find. A lot of people, when you talk to them, say, well, I believe that if you just keep the Ten Commandments, you'll be all right. What is that smell?
Garlic.
Who's got garlic? Someone got an earache or something? Okay. You got, using it for medicinal purposes? I guess there is a blessing in being congested. I can't. I can barely smell it. Okay. Now, getting back to our subject. The Ten Commandments, though almost everyone thinks of them as some kind of a standard by which people will be judged on the Judgment Day, most people who say, my religion is just the Ten Commandments, most people who say that can't even tell you what the Ten Commandments are. In fact, most Christians can't even quote the Ten Commandments, at least not in order. Not that the order is necessarily important, but I suppose it's easier to quote them in order and memorize them in order than some other way. But it's kind of interesting how few Christians or men on the street, or even Jews probably, really can quote the Ten Commandments. And maybe that's not such a great tragedy for the Christian, because the Christian does not use the Ten Commandments as his guide for conduct. He uses the teachings of Christ as his guide for conduct. The Ten Commandments are the loftiest moral code that has ever been given to any nation. That is to say, if you search all the moral codes and the legal codes of all other ancient nations, or even more modern nations, those that have not been affected by the Bible have nothing as lofty and as that extends human rights and purity of conduct to the same levels as the Ten Commandments. It's an incredibly profound document. These ten brief commandments, if they actually encompass, they protect human life, they protect human possessions from theft. They protect the chastity of marriage and the safety of the home. They protect the rights of parents. Though parents at a certain point in their life grow old and infirm, yet the children are commanded to honor them, so that a parent who has children never needs to worry about going hungry or so forth. And so these laws really involve so much in so few words that they have astounded scholars just by their wisdom throughout history, really. And even non-Christians who have studied legal codes of other societies realize that the Jews had the loftiest. Of course, non-Christians don't believe that God gave it to the Jews. They believe it came from Moses himself. If that's true, then he was a genius. And he may have been, for that matter. He was trained in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, but he didn't repeat the wisdom of the Egyptians when he gave the Ten Commandments. He gave something higher than the Egyptians had ever known. And though Moses may have been a genius, we know that he did not make up these laws. Moses received them written by the finger of God in stone. And some people feel that they were written in stone in order to suggest that they were permanently and unbreakably binding, so that even to this day we are under the Ten Commandments. I feel that the New Testament teaches otherwise. We are not under the Ten Commandments, we are under the teaching of Christ. The law was a schoolmaster to bring us to Christ, but once faith in Christ has come, we're no longer under the schoolmaster, Paul said in Galatians 3. In another place, in Romans 7, he said, we were married to the law once, but now we've been made dead to the law so that we might be married to another, even Christ. So that we're dead to that old marriage of the law, and we're under a new husband, Christ. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 9, he said, to the Jew I become as a Jew. To those who are under the law, I become as one under the law. But to those who are without the law, meaning the law of Moses, I live as one without the law. However, he says, I am not without the law to God, but I'm under the law to Christ. Now what he said there is that he has the liberty, if living among Gentiles who don't keep the law of God, he has the liberty not to observe the Mosaic law, the law that Moses gave. But he says, nonetheless, while I am free from the Mosaic law, I am not free from the law of Christ. He says, I'm not without law to God, I am under the law to Christ. So we find that Paul's attitude, and I believe it's absolutely correct, is that we are not under the Mosaic law, including the Ten Commandments. We are under the law of Christ. It so happens that Jesus Christ repeated much of what was in the Mosaic law, and whatever Jesus said is our law. But he went a little deeper than Moses did on some of these points. Now, some people feel that Jesus was simply explaining the true inner depths of what Moses intended, and that may be true. It's not really what Moses intended, what God intended when he gave them. I believe that is true. Jesus showed that the Jews observed these things outwardly, but didn't observe them inwardly. They outwardly didn't commit adultery, but inwardly they did. They outwardly didn't commit murder, but inwardly they did. And so Jesus pointed out that they were transgressors of the law, even if they didn't outwardly break it, because their spirit was not right. The law was not yet written on their hearts. Well, Jesus said also about the law, when he was in the Sermon on the Mount, in Matthew chapter 5, he says, think not that I came to abolish the law or destroy the law and the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For not one jot nor tittle of the law shall pass away until all be fulfilled. That is to say, the law will be binding. Jesus, of course, speaking before he went to the cross, before the new covenant came in, speaking to Jews, he said, this law, I'm not abolishing it, I'm just fulfilling it. Now, what did he mean by that? Fulfilling it means he basically fulfilled what it predicted. It predicted his coming. He also fulfilled it in that he gave it its inner meaning. He told us what its real meaning was. And he said, not one jot or tittle of it will be removed until all is fulfilled. He didn't come as an enemy of the law, but as the fulfillment of it. He was the thing that the law anticipated. And now it has all been fulfilled. The question we might ask is, has one jot or one tittle been done away with from the law? And the answer is obviously yes. The ceremonial laws are universally recognized, almost universally recognized, as not being binding on Christians. We don't have to eat kosher food. We don't have to circumcise our children for religious purposes. We don't have to keep certain holy days like the Jews did. We don't have to offer animal sacrifices as they did. All these things were part of the law. We don't have to go to Jerusalem 3 times a year like the Jews did. All those things were required by the law. Has one jot or tittle of the law passed? Yes, it certainly has. There's many things the law said that we don't do anymore. Those have passed. But Jesus said, not one jot or tittle will pass until all be fulfilled. So that must mean that if any part has passed, the whole thing must be fulfilled. That's only logical. That's the inference from what Jesus said. So we might say, since we know that some parts of the law have passed, then all the law has been fulfilled. Because it's not going to, it stands or falls as a unit. It's, part of it's not going to trickle out, and part of it still remains. When all of it is fulfilled, that's when the rest of it, that's when it will go. And so we live in a time after Christ has established a new covenant. The Ten Commandments were part of the Old Covenant. They were the covenant law. We are not under that covenant. We are under a better covenant. Now that doesn't mean we're off the hook and now we can go out and steal and commit adultery and kill and do all the things that the law forbade and fail to show honor to our parents and curse God and so forth. We can't do that because Jesus forbade those things. In fact, he put a heavier, or I shouldn't say heavier, but I should say a more strict requirement upon us, because he said we also have to keep these things inwardly. But there's one thing very important to notice about this. Of all the Ten Commandments, Jesus repeated 9, but there's one that he never repeated. And that is the fourth commandment about keeping the Sabbath. He repeated 9 of the Ten Commandments in one form or another during his teaching and established their continuing validity. Not because they belong to the Decalogue, but simply because they belong to God's permanent and abiding requirements upon man. And that's why Jesus repeated them and stressed them, because we're under his teaching, not under Moses. So he told us, keep those. And he didn't name them all in one place. He didn't list out 9 of the Ten Commandments, but you can find in the teaching of Jesus, in one form or another, each of the 9 finds expression in Jesus' teaching. But there's not a single reference in the New Testament of Jesus teaching that we should keep Sabbath. In fact, we find from his own example that he was constantly butting heads with the Pharisees because he didn't keep Sabbath. And the reason I stress this is because there are Christians today who believe that we must keep the Sabbath. And they stress, well, why do you keep 9 of the Ten Commandments and you don't keep the fourth commandment? Obviously, the Seventh-day Adventists are of this group, but there's many other groups, Christians, that do that. They keep the seventh day, Saturday Sabbath, and they say that all Christians must do that. And they say we're inconsistent because we keep 9 of the Ten Commandments, but we don't keep the fourth. And, of course, the answer to that is we don't keep any of the Ten Commandments. We keep the commandments of Jesus. It just so happens some of his commandments overlap the Ten Commandments. And so by obeying him, we happen to be living within the boundaries that were also set by the Ten. But we're not keeping 9 of the Ten Commandments. We're keeping all the commandments of Christ. And that does not include any command about the Sabbath. Now, Paul apparently thought this way. Let me show you something in the New Testament about this. In Colossians chapter 2, Paul, of course, is writing to Christians who are under the new covenant, and therefore he believes that they're not under the old covenant. But in Colossians chapter 2, verse 16, he said, "Let no man therefore judge you in meat or in drink," that is, in what you eat or drink, "or in respect of any holy day, or of new moon, or of Sabbath days, which are a shadow of things to come, but the body is of Christ." Now Paul says, don't let anyone judge you or make you feel condemned about any obligation to eat certain things or drink certain things or keep certain holy days or even the Sabbath day. Now the only reason Paul could ever say don't let anyone judge you about this is because you're not under a law about it. If you were under the law about it, people would of course be in the position to judge you, because the law would judge you itself. And of course we do judge within in the body of Christ. Paul said we do judge those who are within to see if they're doing what they're supposed to do. That's our obligation. We judge righteous judgment. We don't judge according to appearance, but we do judge according to our obligation. If someone's doing something that violates the teaching of Christ, we have to say, hey brother, that's wrong what you're doing. You need to do something different. But Paul said Sabbath is not one of those things that anyone has the right to judge anyone about. It's apparently not a requirement of us. And he said that was just a shadow of things to come, a type of Christ, in a sense, which we'll see in a moment what sense that is. But let's look over at Romans 14. Romans 14. Paul, in this chapter, is talking about differences among Christians and how we need to be tolerant of differences that Christians hold about non-essential matters. Paul himself was not tolerant about differences about essential matters like the deity of Christ or the lordship of Christ. Those are essential points. But on many smaller, less essential points, Christians should have the latitude given to them to differ with other Christians about how they understand a certain thing, an issue, like whether you should eat meat or not. That's one of the things he talks about in this chapter. Another one has to do with how you see the Sabbath day. In verse 5, Romans 14:5, he says, "One man esteems one day above another. Another man esteems every day alike. Let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind. He that regards the day regards it unto the Lord. And he that regards not the day, to the Lord he does not regard it. He that eateth, eateth to the Lord, and he giveth God thanks. But he that eateth not, to the Lord he eateth not, and he giveth God thanks." Now what he's saying here essentially is that there are some differences among Christians that are not in essential matters. What you eat, how you regard certain days, those are not essential matters to Christians. Some hold one opinion, some hold another opinion. He says, "My counsel is just let everyone do what their own conscience dictates." Now he couldn't have said that if there was a binding obligation on Christians to keep one day above the rest. Paul could never have said, "One man esteems one day above another, but others don't, but that's okay, whatever you want. I mean, whatever you're fully persuaded in your own mind." Paul could never give people that liberty if God didn't give people that liberty. See? And so he's clearly stating that God does not require us to keep one day above another anymore. As he said also in Colossians, don't let anyone judge you about Sabbath days or holy days. Those are all part of the old system. The body that to which they look forward is Christ. Now, of course, that brings up the question of whether the Sabbath day has been changed to Sunday. We know the Jewish Sabbath was Saturday, and some people think, well, Jesus changed it to Sunday when he rose from the dead on Sunday. That's highly debatable as to whether he rose right on Sunday or whether it was technically a Saturday evening when he rose. But it doesn't even matter because the Bible nowhere says that the resurrection day of Jesus was to be celebrated on a weekly basis or that the disciples ever changed the Sabbath. In fact, in the book of Acts we find they did meet on the first day of the week, but they never called it a Sabbath. In fact, quite clearly, they didn't call it the Sabbath because they met on Saturdays in the synagogues, and the book of Acts calls that the Sabbath. It says, on the Sabbath days, Paul went in and reasoned with the Jews in the synagogue. That could only be Saturday. He wouldn't find any Jews on the synagogue on Sunday. So the book of Acts, which is after the resurrection of Christ, still calls Saturday the Sabbath to the Jews. But the disciples did not observe the Sabbath in the Jewish manner. They went to synagogue, but just to preach. They just went there because they knew there'd be a crowd, a place to evangelize. But when the church met together, it is true, in the book of Acts, chapter 20, it mentions they met together on the first day of the week. Also in 1 Corinthians 16, it mentions that they gathered on the first day of the week, that's Sunday. So the early church did meet on Sundays. They also went to synagogue on Sabbath to preach. But we don't find them calling Sunday a Sabbath ever, and I don't believe the Sabbath ever was changed to Sunday except by an ecclesiastical decree of the church several centuries later. And I don't acknowledge Sunday as a Sabbath or Saturday as a Sabbath because I esteem every day alike. Every day has to be holy to the Lord as far as I'm concerned. If someone really says, well, on one day a week I really devote myself to God, I say, well, why don't you do it the other six? You know? On one day of the week, I can't watch television because I just feel like that'd be profaning the Sabbath. Well, if it profanes one day, why doesn't it profane the other six? Whatever you can't do on Sunday, you shouldn't do any other day. One man esteems one day above another, but of another man, like Paul, I believe, did, esteemed every day the same. Every day is a holy day because my whole life is devoted to the Lord. Working, once again, working was forbidden on the Sabbath day under the Old Testament. The day God rested on the seventh day. But again, he never commanded men to do that until Exodus chapter 16. Then he told them not to go collect manna on the Sabbath day. Then in the Ten Commandments, he told them not to work, not to labor on the Sabbath day. That was all part of the Old Covenant. If we were under the Sabbath law, we'd have to still not work. We're not under the Sabbath law, so there's no New Testament. Right. There's nothing under the New Testament that says we have to rest one day. But let me state this. The Bible says, Jesus said, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath, which means that God gave man the Sabbath for man's own good. Man's not obligated under Christ to keep the Sabbath as before, but it is for his own good to do so. Doctors also know that it's healthiest for a man to have at least one day out of seven to rest, or else his nerves will get shot, you know, he'll burn out. So it is still advisable to avoid work one day a week, to actually do your work 6 days of the week, and then rest a seventh. But there's a difference between saying it's advisable and saying it's required. Right. Or what day it is either. So I'm simply saying we're not under the law of the Sabbath, according to Paul. But that doesn't mean that there's no continuing value in it. When I meet people who keep Sabbath one day a week, I say, more power to you. That's a wise thing to do. I mean, God never gave laws, but that didn't make sense. When he said to do that to the Jews, it must have been because it was good for them to do that. And Jesus even said so. God gave the Sabbath for man. It's for man's benefit. And if you want to derive all the benefits you can out of life, you should keep the Sabbath. But that doesn't mean God's going to judge you someday as to whether you kept the Sabbath or not. And if you work on Sunday or if you work on Saturday, that doesn't violate any command of God. It's not a moral issue. It's just a matter of doing that which is good for you. Okay? So I didn't mean to spend the whole time here talking about the Sabbath, but that is the one of the Ten Commandments that stands out as being the one of the commandments that Jesus didn't repeat. Now, the New Testament indicates that the Sabbath is fulfilled in Christ and that we have come into a spiritual rest from our attempts to earn our salvation by our own works. We have ceased from our own works in that respect, and we've come into a spiritual rest. Jesus said, if you come unto me, I'll give you rest. And that is the rest that I think the Sabbath law was a type of. It was a type of something. Paul said those things were shadows of something, and the fulfillment of them is Christ. So we actually keep Sabbath in a different sense. We come into the rest of Christ. Once a week, the Jews had to keep one day of no servile work. The purpose of that was to convey to them the thought that there was a rest that God was providing for man. But later it was revealed through Christ that rest was a spiritual rest. It was not a cessation of physical work. It was a cessation of a works righteousness where we look to our own works in any sense for our salvation. We look to the finished work of Christ and we rest in Him. So that is all I really want to give time to say about the Sabbath. There's much more. We have a whole tape on the Sabbath. In fact, I want to say this. To take all 10 of the 10 commandments in one session, as we are going to have to do, requires, of course, that we be very brief and only take the most, the highlights that I feel we have to do. But as some of you know, if you were here last summer, we had a whole series of teachings on, in fact, it was the summer before, I guess, or sometime very recently, we had a whole series of teachings on the 10 commandments. Spent 2 weeks on one commandment in a few cases. On the one about honoring father and mother, we have 2 hour-and-a-half tapes on that. Also on the one about adultery, we have 2 hour-and-a-half tapes on it. And then the others, I think we had one week given to each commandment. So if you want to go deeper into the Ten Commandments, you can do so with our tapes on the subject, but we won't be able to go as deeply as they deserve, of course, now because of our schedule for covering material. And God spake all these words, saying... Now remember, this is probably an audible voice from the mountain to the people. And they reacted in fear and revulsion after they heard it. He spoke, saying, I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of bondage. Now he's pointing out that he's different from all other gods, and that gives the basis for his making demands upon them. The reason they should keep his commandments is because of this. They owe their lives to him. He brought them out of the land of Egypt. They owe him obedience, and this is what obedience will require. In verse 3, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children, unto the third and the fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is thy neighbor's. Now those are the Ten Commandments. Various denominations and groups have broken them up into different fragments to make ten. In general, I believe that I can speak with the consensus of the majority of Christians that the commandments to not covet all belong in one commandment. I believe that the Roman Catholic Church has combined some of the earlier commandments into one and broken the last one into two. But I believe verse 17 embodies one commandment. And I'd like to look at these real quickly. The first two commandments obviously have to do with worshiping God. The first one says, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Now, before me doesn't mean that you put above me or ahead of me. Before me means in my presence. Which means, it doesn't mean it's okay to have other gods as long as you put God first. And some people don't realize that. They say, yes, I have other things that are really important in my life, but I put Jesus first. Well, Jesus has to be your whole life. Nothing can really be important except Jesus. And then, of course, those things that he says are important to him become important to you. But you can't independently say, okay, these things are important to me, and Jesus is too, and I just happen to put Jesus at the top. He's the first priority. God didn't say it's okay to have other gods lower than him and just have no other gods above him. Have no other gods before me means have no other gods in my presence. In other words, realizing that you live in the presence of God and he is watching you and you sit before his throne and walk and move before his face daily. You are before him every moment of your life. Therefore, you should live in accordance with that knowledge and have no other gods in your life. It's quite inappropriate to stand before the king with other kings holding on to you and saying that they have some claim on some part of your life. So he's basically saying, in my presence you shall have no other gods. The second commandment also relates to worship, and that is more not who to worship, but how to worship. You shall not make graven images. Now this has been a confusing thing, and some people don't believe that anyone should wear jewelry or should wear pictures. Tony, when he was here, said there was a certain Christian of a certain denomination who felt like this opposed pictures, and while he stayed in their house, he tore down all the pictures they had in the house of anything. You see, it's not just a matter of making images of God, it's of anything. Animals, man, anything above the earth or under the earth. In other words, any graven image of any object is equally forbidden, but it's not that the images themselves are forbidden, but to make them as an object of worship is forbidden, because the part of the commandment continues, the sentence continues in verse 5. Verse 4 only gives part of the sentence. But when God finishes out his thought, when he says, you shall not make any graven image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, and so forth, he says, you shall not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord, thy God, am a jealous God. So, clearly he's saying, you shall not make any object of worship. You shall not make an image. And it's very obvious that in the societies that surrounded the Jews at this time, idolatry, the worshiping of actual carved images of animals and of people and of gods and goddesses, was a very common practice. And what he's forbidding here is idolatry. He's not making some kind of statement that all statues are evil. In fact, if he were saying that, then he violated his own law and commanded the Jews to do so when he told them to engrave cherubim, images of the cherubim, over the mercy seat in the tabernacle. That would have been a violation of this commandment if all graven images were forbidden. It's not forbidden to make these images. It's forbidden to make them as objects of worship. The Jews did not worship the cherubim. They were not intended to, in any sense, worship the cherubim. They were supposed to make images of the cherubim, not only out of gold on the mercy seat, but also in the embroidery of the curtains of the tabernacle and of the veils of the tabernacle. They all had pictures of cherubim that the Jews were supposed to make. Now, it's very evident, then, that making pictures and even statues is not forbidden. But in any sense, to make any kind of an image, and I believe this would even go on to mental images. When we begin to try to visualize God in some mental way, the reason, of course, this is wrong is because it limits God. He is vast beyond imagining. He is not as small as our imagination. He can't fit in there. There's too much of him. There's too many aspects of him, too many features, too many characteristics. His attributes go beyond the imagination. He's more than we could imagine. Therefore, as A.W. Tozer said, anyone who tries to imagine God will have an imaginary God. Because the true God cannot be confined to the borders of our imagination. And as soon as you begin to imagine him, or imagine him under some image, immediately what you're doing is you're putting restrictions on what he is. If you imagine him as a man, well, there are some features of God that are revealed to be somewhat human-like. We are made in his image, and yet that's a limitation. He can't be limited to the confines of what an image of a man represents. If you think of his strength and want to represent him as a bull and make a statue of a bull to represent God for his strength, well, that's limiting him too. He's not just that, because a bull isn't intelligent. A bull doesn't have a spirit. And so therefore, no image you could really make of him would really adequately cover it. Every image of God ends up being part of polytheism. In order to really cover all the aspects of God with imagery, you'd have to have several different images to cover it. So you end up with several different gods. And that's what the problem with polytheism is. Polytheistic religions generally have a god of rain, a god of the earth, a god of the ocean, a god of the river, a god of the trees, a god of this, a god of that. Whereas the true God is the God of everything and more. And what they do is, because they try to confine God to levels that can be imagined, they limited him to his different attributes and assign each one to a different image and a different God. And that's where they lose track of who God really is, the transcendent, unimaginable God. Not unknowable, but unimaginable. And therefore, I think it's equally wrong to when we're praying, to try to visualize God entirely and say, and as though we have some kind of an accurate picture in our minds of what he is. Because that's making an image too, if we're worshiping that image. I have trouble with pictures of Jesus that are in churches. I realize that people may not be worshiping them. But I know also that it's kind of hard when you're worshiping the Lord facing the front of the building and there's a picture of Jesus there. It's kind of hard not to connect that picture with him. And we say, well, it helps us to picture Jesus. Well, you know, I don't want to get too heavy about it or anything like that, but I think that's the kind of thing that God's trying to wean us of. He wants us to have a spiritual apprehension of him rather than an imaginary one or a physical or visible one. And so I think those are the principles embodied in this command. Now, we can't, of course, ignore the motives that God gives here for keeping this command. One thing that's interesting is the first five commandments, the first four have to do with God, and then the fifth one has to do with honoring father and mother. Those first five commandments, each of them have a motive attached to them. In other words, God says, don't do this because of this reason. Whereas the last five don't have any motive attached. Just, you shall not kill, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet. No motives are given in writing for those last five, but for the first five, every time God says, don't do it because of this. In the case of the first commandment, it's because he is the God that brought them out of Egypt, therefore they should have no other gods before him. As far as making graven images, he is quite convinced that if people made graven images, they begin to have an imaginary God instead of the true God. They're worshiping other gods of their own making. And he said, the reason you shouldn't do that is because I'm a jealous God. Verse 5, and I visit the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and the fourth generation of them that hate me. However, he does show mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. Now, what does this mean, that he's a jealous God and he visits the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation? It's very clear that this is directly associated with the command against idolatry. And we shouldn't try to apply it beyond the boundaries of that context necessarily, though some of these statements may have in principle application outside that context, yet we can't be dogmatic. We have to say that within the context we can see application. Outside this context, we don't want to stretch the principle too far. In saying he's a jealous God, we might say, well, he's admitting to sin, because the Bible teaches that jealousy and envy are wrong. But they're only wrong for us, because jealousy and envy actually is something that is caused by our selfishness and our, you know, I'm envious of that person, I'm jealous of that person because they have something I don't have, and it's assuming that I deserve to have it, you see. The trouble is I don't deserve to have it. Therefore, I'm coveting and envying somebody for something that isn't rightly mine anyway. It's a grasping, covetous, greedy kind of a thing on my part. However, God has the right to be jealous. Just like a husband, in a sense, has a right to be jealous over his wife if his wife's not committing adultery. It says in Proverbs 6, jealousy is the rage of a husband when his wife is committing adultery. And it seems to say that's valid. If a man's wife is out sleeping with other men, it's natural and valid for him to be jealous because, of course, he has a right to her being loyal to him. She's pledged herself to him. And that's the kind of jealousy God has. He has a jealousy over his wife, Israel. He's jealous over his purchased possession. She is his bride, and if she worships other gods, his jealousy is going to flare out against those gods and against the adulterous wife. And that's what he's saying. Now he says, I visit the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. Which means, of course, them that hate me is to be equated with those who are idolaters. Those who worship idols bring upon not only themselves, but very possibly, in many cases, several generations after them, judgment. Now, this does not mean that if you worshiped an idol, that your children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren will all go to hell. They may be saved, and you might even be saved. You could be forgiven and so forth. But God, of course, will judge every individual, ultimately, as far as eternal judgment is concerned, on the basis of their own choices. But it is also true that we know that the decisions of a king affect all those who are under him. And the decisions of a head of household affect the circumstances of others. We know, for instance, that if a father or a mother is a heroin addict, especially a mother, it's possible for her to pass down heroin addiction to her child. It's not the child's fault. God doesn't hold the child accountable, but the child is suffering for the sins of the parents. In a case where the mother contracts syphilis because of a sinful sexual relationship, the child might be born blind. Well, God doesn't hold the child accountable for the mother's sins, but the child still suffers. The iniquity of the parent is being visited, or in a sense, the consequences are being passed down to another generation. In the case of spiritual adultery, it passes down for several generations. I was reading a book by a man named Kurt Koch, who's an expert on the occult. He's a Christian. He's an expert on demonism. He's cast many demons out of many people and written many books that are authoritative on the subject. And he was telling about a case where, I think he was in Africa, at a missionary school, dealing with a young man who was demon-possessed. And he was seeking to cast this demon out, and the demon said, you can't cast me out because we have been in this man's family for 300 years. Now, of course, let me hasten to say you cannot build biblical doctrine on the basis of what demons say. Demons can be liars. But we also know they sometimes tell the truth. You just can't count on them. You can't be sure they're telling the truth at any time. The demon said, Jesus, we know who you are. You're the Holy One of God. Well, they were telling the truth. But they can't be trusted to tell the truth, and people go to get themselves in big trouble when they begin to build doctrine on the basis of what they learned from a demon when they were talking to someone, trying to cast a demon out. The demon speaks out, oh, wow, I learned some interesting things, Well, I only quote what this demon said because it seems to confirm what the Bible says in this case. It seems like the demon could have been telling the truth. Men who have deliverance ministries, who deal extensively with demon-possessed people, are all convinced that demons are passed down sometimes from generation to generation. People say, well, that's hardly fair if a mother or a father is into the occult, for their child to be born demon-possessed. That's not fair. And it's true, it's not fair. God never said the devil's fair. In fact, the Bible tells us very plainly the devil doesn't play fair. But if a parent is foolish enough to invite a demon into their body and into their life, they need to know that they're not only taking the risk upon themselves, but that demon may affect their whole family for many generations unless deliverance comes in. And of course, deliverance can end that chain of oppression real quick. But in many cases, the people never find deliverance, and demons are passed down. And while we know it's not fair, it doesn't mean it doesn't happen. We know, for example, that sometimes children are born physically handicapped. That doesn't seem fair. A kid born with, a deformed hand or born blind or something like that. We also know sometimes children are born retarded or mongoloid. That's a mental handicap. And it's just the same is true. They can also be born spiritually handicapped. We know for a fact children are born physically handicapped sometimes, and or mentally handicapped. Well, it is also revealed, I believe, in this verse, and has been confirmed through the experience of missionaries and others who deal with the demon possessed, that demon possession, a spiritual handicap, can be born into a child. We seem to see it in a case where the man brought his son to Jesus, his little boy to Jesus, and the demon or brought it to the disciples, and the disciples couldn't cast the demon out, and Jesus came down and successfully did so. But before he cast the demon out, Jesus said, "How long has he been this way?" And the man said, "From childhood," which is a very unspecific answer. In fact, the person who had the demon seemed to still be a child. But in saying "from childhood," it seems though he's saying, as long as we can remember. I mean, from his earliest days, we can't remember a time when he wasn't like this. So there's a good possibility this is a child who had been born possessed, or if not, at least had been possessed at a very early age. Now, the sins of the fathers being passed down to the third and fourth generation may not be specifically a reference to this phenomenon. But it is well known that when you worship idols, you're worshiping demons. Paul said that. Paul said that in 1 Corinthians 10:20. He says, "Know ye not that the sacrifices that the heathen offer, they offer unto demons and not unto gods?" They're actually offering sacrifices to demons. They think they're offering to an idol. People who are introduced into TM, for instance, transcendental medication. The reason I said that is because of a joke I heard about a man who went to a dentist to have an extraction, and the doctor said, do you want me to put you out for this? And the guy says, "No, I want to transcend dental medication." But anyway, transcendental meditation is a Hindu practice which Westerners have gotten into, sometimes thinking it's not religious, but in fact, the initiation into it is offering an actual sacrifice of fruit offered on white linen to a picture of a dead guru. Maharishi's dead guru, Guru Dev. And it's actually offering sacrifice to idols. And Paul says that's offering sacrifice to demons. Now, when Paul talked about that further, in that same chapter, 1 Corinthians 10, he said, when we eat the bread of the Lord's table, we're having communion with the Lord. We're coming into oneness with the Lord. He says, you shall not eat at the Lord's table and the table of demons. I don't want you to have union with the Lord and union with demons. You see? So when a person is actually worshiping an altar of a demon or of an idol, they are uniting themselves with a demon. And though they may not think of themselves as being haters of God, you can't serve two masters. You'll either love the one and hate the other, or cling to one and despise the other. If you worship any other god than God, you are worshiping a demon. You might not call it that, but that's what it is. When you worship demons, you are very much in danger of being demon-possessed, obviously. That's how demon possession usually happens, through people involved in the occult and worshiping false gods. And that's what this is warning against. Don't do that. God says, I'm a jealous God. This is going to affect more than you. It may affect several generations if you don't get deliverance. And so, really, probably the way this was understood among the Jews, and it's a valid way also, was that when the Jews practiced idolatry, later the judgment of God came on them. They were sent into Babylon in captivity. They were there for 70 years, which affected three or four generations of Jews who suffered for the sins of their fathers. Their fathers had worshipped idols, and the Jews in captivity didn't. The whole 70 years, none of them worshipped idols, but they still suffered, several generations of them. And so the sins of the fathers were visited for three or four generations upon them in that case. Could also be seen, and as Sean mentioned, I think it was, of the 400 years they spent in exile in Egypt. That God says, I visit the iniquity of the fathers on the children for third and fourth generation of them that hate me. Joseph's brothers had hated God and Joseph, and their offspring for several generations suffered in bondage in Egypt. So there, we can see that this has a natural as well as a spiritual application. That the judgments that God brings upon a people or a family for their hatred of Him, for their idolatry, for their demon worship and their occultism, can result in judgment, either in the form of physical captivity, as in those cases, or spiritual bondage for a number of generations. And there are people who have received demons and passed them down in this way. There are other ways, of course, people can be demon-possessed, but being born with a demon is one of them. And that's kind of a heavy thing. This principle seems to... You shouldn't swear by him at all, nor should you swear by heaven, nor by earth, nor by even your own head. Because you don't have control over the future. You can't even change one of your hairs on your head, white or black. This is before the days of Clairol. And he's basically saying, since you don't have control of the future, you better not make any oaths about what you're going to do in the future. You might die. You might not be able to fulfill your oath. So you're better off not making any oaths at all. But the point here is that in the Old Testament, it was not forbidden to make vows and oaths. And it was not even forbidden to vow in the name of the Lord. But it was wrong to do so if you were not going to absolutely keep your vow. And the vow you make in the name of the Lord was absolutely binding. You can read Ecclesiastes 5 to see how Solomon understood this. He says, when you come to the house of the Lord, and it's implied to make your vows, it says, you be careful not to speak too much, not to speak too hastily, because your God does not delight in the sacrifice of fools. So it's better not to make a vow than to make a vow and not keep it, because God would have to judge you for that. So taking the Lord's name in vain is that way. And another, a third way that is perhaps more general but still as important is that the Jews in general took the Lord's name upon them as a people. They were the people of Jehovah. His name was associated with them. They were his bride. A bride always takes her husband's name upon her and is associated with him. And so as his wife, they had his name upon them. It's as though my wife and I, before we were married, got together and I said, will you marry me? And she said, sure. And I said, now, you're not going to do anything to bring shame or reproach on my name, are you? Oh, of course not. I'll always do the right thing. But then we get married, and then she runs off and does things in my name, signs checks with my name that are, you know, bounce all over the place. And now, she's never done that, but I mean, she's using my name. She's taking my name upon her, but she's abusing it. She's claiming to be a representation of my family, my good name, and so forth, but she's really dragging it through the mud, you see. She's not representing me, even though she has my name. Now, when you take the Lord's name on you, and you're called a Christian because the name Christ is added to your designation, you've taken his name on you. But you shouldn't do so emptily. That is, it shouldn't just be an empty word. You don't just call yourself a Christian and then go off and do your own thing. You are his bride. You submit to him. You do what he wants you to do. If you call yourself a Christian and don't live for Christ, you're taking his name in vain. Just as the Jews, when they called themselves the people of Jehovah, but they didn't please Jehovah, they violated his laws, they were taking his name in vain. So there's all these things are involved in taking the Lord's name in vain. Swearing falsely, using his name irreverently, or of course even calling yourself by his name. That is, calling yourself a Christian, or them calling themselves one of God's people, and yet not living for him, because it's a false taking of his name, and they're taking it emptily or in vain. Well, we're running low on time. Let's go on to the next one. Next one, of course, is keep the Sabbath holy. The reason he gives for that is because of the creation. God rested on the Sabbath day. That was to set a precedent for the Jews that they should do the same thing. We've already talked at length about this at the beginning of this session. We won't take the time to do so again. But the Jews, by the way, were very strictly to keep this law. The Old Covenant did not take this Sabbath thing lightly. And perhaps the reason for that is because the spiritual truth to which it looked forward was so important. The importance of being saved by grace, not by our own works. The importance of coming into Christ and resting in his finished work and not struggling and laboring to attain to a level of righteousness that God would accept. But the whole concept of salvation by grace is bound up in this concept of rest, resting in the Lord. And that is such an important concept that the shadow of it, or the type of it that God wanted to give in the Old Testament, must never be violated, so that it would be deeply ingrained that there was a rest that God provides, and it would eventually be understood as a spiritual rest. Now, the point is here that it was so much driven in home that once a man who gathered sticks for a fire on the Sabbath was commanded by God to be put to death. Now, people might say, well, that's hardly a just thing. Why should a man be put to death just for gathering sticks on the Sabbath? And the answer to that is because he knew better and he was violating the law of God. Any violation of the law of God is worthy of death. And God wanted to make an example of this person so that people would know he means business. Remember when he told them not to go out and gather manna on the Sabbath? They did it anyway, but he didn't kill them. He was merciful. He could have. He just didn't. But on one occasion where he did, to make an example and say, listen, I mean business about this, people would get all upset. But really, God just wanted to make sure we know that he means business by this Sabbath business. Now, of course, we'll run into this so much in the Old Testament. God said, keep the Sabbath, keep the Sabbath, keep the Sabbath. As a Christian reading this, you can kind of get put under bondage. Well, wow, I really better keep the Sabbath. But realize, of course, there is a spiritual Sabbath that is being stressed to us. They were living under a different covenant than we are. Now, the next one, interestingly, belongs to both groups of laws. We said the first four have to do with responsibility and love toward God. The last six have to do with love toward man and responsibility toward man. But the last five in particular have to do with our responsibility toward all men. Whereas the fifth commandment about honoring father and mother has to do with only certain men and women. That is to say, it sort of borders on the other, because the father and the mother are God's appointed authorities, and to show honor to them is to show honor to God also. He is not here telling us to honor everybody's father and everybody's mother, nor to honor all men, although we're later told to do that in 1 Peter. Yet he is saying you must honor your father and mother. We have to love all men, but we don't have to necessarily respect all men. But we do have to respect our parents and honor them. Now, this also is seen to belong to the first group of commandments too, in that it is there's a motive attached to it, which there aren't to the last five. Just as the first four commandments each have some motive given for doing so, so does this one. You shall honor your father and mother, that your days may be long upon the land which thy Lord, the Lord thy God giveth thee. This may mean that if they honored their father and their mother in the sense that they kept the religion that God had given the former generation, God would never have to drive them out for their idolatry and their rebellion. But if they departed from their father and their mother's ways and went into idolatry and such, they would lose the land. They'd lose the possession and God would judge them. At any rate, we know that the New Testament makes a big deal about this matter of honor to father and mother. Jesus, no less, established it, and he criticized the Pharisees because they had certain things in their traditions of their rabbis that seemed to preempt this. They had a tradition that said if your father and mother are poor and you're rich, whereas you ought to, of course, ordinarily provide for them, but if you didn't want to do that, you could dedicate your possessions to God formally, which means that you couldn't give them to anyone else, including your parents, so that you could avoid meeting your obligation to your parents. Now, Jesus said this is hypocrisy, and he says this is satanic, really. He said, Moses said, you shall honor your father and your mother. And so it's very clear that honoring your father and your mother included supporting them when they're old, because that's the example Jesus gave. He said that this tradition the Jews had that eliminated the obligation for a child to support his old parents was a violation of this command, Jesus said, because God, we do owe our parents a living when they're older. Now, you see, there's many principles involved here. One is simply respect for the aged. Another is a matter of obligation. It's just a matter of fairness. Your parents nurtured you. They raised you. They fed you when you were too little to feed yourself. They lost sleep over you. You never lost any sleep for them when you were a baby. If they didn't keep you awake, but you sure kept them awake a lot. You never had to change their diapers, but they had to change yours a lot. You never had to feed them or support them, but they did that for you, and they never got anything out of it. I mean, except maybe some satisfaction. If you turned out to be okay in life, they might say, well, we're satisfied that our child turned out in a way that we're not ashamed of. But they have never been repaid. You've never even started to repay your parents. And when they are old, the Bible says it is the obligation of children to support their old parents. Paul said this about widows in 1 Timothy chapter 5. He said the church should support old widows who are widows indeed, meaning widows who have no children to support them. But he said, if any man has a mother or an aunt or a relative who's a widow, let him support them, and let not the church be burdened. And then he said this, for if any man provide not for those of his own household, he's worse, he's denied the faith, and he's worse than an unbeliever. Now, I know we usually think of a husband supporting his wife and children and use that verse, but in the context, he's talking about supporting aged parents. Your own parents who get too old to work. Of course, this is the day before they had retirement and so forth. The whole burden of support for aged parents fell upon their children. And that's why they had extended families in the household. The grandparents would come and live, and the great-grandparents, and there would be several generations living in one house. Because the youngest, most virile, the people in their prime, were supporting the older generation that was no longer able to support themselves. And Paul said anyone who refused to do that is worse than an unbeliever, because even unbelievers do that. See? He says you've denied the faith. So to support your aged parents is part of honoring your father and mother. Jesus said so and Paul said so. But honor also suggests respect. Now, some things about your parents you can't respect, especially if they're not Christians. If you do have Christian parents And if they had any part in leading you to the Lord, then you are, of course, doubly indebted to them. Besides bringing you into the world, they are your spiritual parents as well, and they have done you a service that you would never, ever be able to repay them. And you owe them honor and respect for it. But even if your parents are not Christians, even if your parents ran out on you, if your father abandoned you or your mother abandoned you, yet you were alive. You were brought into this world by them. Maybe it was even against their will, but nonetheless, God used them to bring you into the world so that you could live forever and know God, so that you could have the privilege that many people die without ever seeing, and that is the privilege of knowing God, which you do know Him. You are going to reign with Christ for all eternity, and the only reason that's possible is because your parents had you. They might not have wanted you. You might have been an unwanted child. They might have abandoned you, but it doesn't change the fact that they are the instruments. God could have chosen different instruments to bring you in. He could have easily done it. He could have put your spirit in another baby, in another place, in another time. But He gave you the parents you have, and He commands you honor them. And the honor is due, really, because of the basic obligation we have to them because they brought us into this world. And that it was God's plan for us to come into this world so that we might know Him. So that our parents knew it or not, they were the agents of God to bring you into the world to find God. And they may not ever find Him themselves, but they still were the tools, and you are forever indebted to them for that. And by the way, David said, when my father and my mother forsake me, the Lord will take me up. But the only reason you could ever have the Lord take you up is because you did have a father and mother. Even though they did forsake you, you had a father and a mother who brought you to this world, and then the Lord was able to take you up. So it doesn't even matter whether your parents have been good parents, whether they were Christian parents, whether they were totally, maybe they weren't even married. Maybe they never took responsibility. Maybe you were adopted. But the point is that God used a certain man and a certain woman to bring you into the world. And because of that, you can see that they played a role in the overall purpose of God for your life. And your obligation is to show them respect and honor and to, if any way, you know, pay them back. At least give them the honor that comes from knowing that their child is a good person. The Bible says that a child left to himself brings his mother to shame. It's evident that the way a child turns out brings either honor or shame to the parents. When you see a child that's well behaved, you say those parents must be doing something right. You know, the parent gets the respect, because so many children just run wild and disobedient. When you see a well behaved parent, a well behaved child, you say that must have wise parents. You know, and just by being a good person and becoming productive for God and so forth, you bring honor to your parents, because people will say those parents did something right. So there's many ways in which we bring honor to our parents. We go into depth on this. I actually spend 2 hour-and-a-half tapes in our series on this subject. Thou shalt not kill. Now, we need to make very clear, this, strictly speaking, means you shall not murder. It is not a forbidding to eat animals. Some vegetarians use this to say we shouldn't kill animals because the Bible says you shall not kill. If God meant that, then He violated His own law many, many times by commanding the Jews to eat a lamb every Passover, to sacrifice bulls and goats and lambs on a continual daily basis. If God meant don't kill animals, He sure was schizophrenic, because He changed His mind every day about it. But the point is, this is not talking about eating animals. As far as that goes, if we just use the word kill in the general sense, we should never eat plants either, because you have to kill them to eat them. You pull them up, you know, when you harvest the wheat, it dies, you know. So, and that's killing too. But the point is here, there's only a specific kind of killing that's forbidden. And it's not even, in every case, the killing of people. Because some killing of people was even sanctioned. As we know, God sanctioned war in several cases. God actually commanded the Jews to go and kill certain people. He also commanded the magistrates to kill murderers. That was even made back in the days of Noah. He that sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. All these things simply say that thou shalt not kill does not forbid every case of killing. Now, I'm not saying that Christians should go out and kill under any circumstances. I don't believe Christians should fight in war. I don't believe a Christian should be the agent who exercises capital punishment. That's not the Christian's duty or his obligation. His obligation is to love all people, including his enemies, and to have a redemptive relationship to them. But what I'm saying is we cannot use this commandment to condemn all war, to condemn capital punishment, to condemn eating meat. In other words, I'm trying to say what this commandment intended and what it did not intend. The specific thing forbidden here is murder, where a person out of malice for another person kills them. And That's a very different thing than exacting exact justice, as an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a life for a life. That's a different issue. We're talking now about a person who hates another person and wants to get rid of them and kills them. And that's why Jesus, when he spoke about this command, said, you've heard that it was said in old times that thou shalt not kill, and whoever killeth shall be subject to the judgment. And he said, well, I say unto you, if you're even angry at your brother without a cause, you'll be subject to the judgment. Suggesting that anger is really the motive behind the forbidden form of killing. It's murder that stems from anger that's wrong. And he said, you should not only not murder, you should not even have that kind of anger. And in 1 John, we even get it stated in another way, but very similarly. 1 John chapter 3 says, I think it's 1 John 3, isn't it? Where he says that he that hateth his brother is a murderer. And you know that no murderer hath eternal life abiding in him. I think that's 1 John 3, let me see here. Yeah, 1 John 3:15. Whoso hateth his brother is a murderer. And you know that no murderer hath eternal life abiding in him. What we get from this and from Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount is this. Murder, the forbidden form of killing, is that which springs out of personal anger, vengeance, hatred, malice. In other words, an evil heart. A judge who throws the switch to execute a capital criminal may not feel any malice at all. He may be just carrying out his duties. Now, I'm not in favor. I don't want to say that I'm coming out in favor of capital punishment. But I'm not going to come out against it either, because the Bible neither comes out against it, nor does it reinstate it in the New Testament. It certainly was instated in the Old Testament. In fact, adulterers were supposed to be killed. Children who were disobedient to their parents were to be stoned to death. All kinds of people were to be put to death under the Old Covenant. Those things seem to be lifted, at least as far as the church is concerned, in the New, when the adulteress was brought to Jesus, and they said, well, the law says we should stone her. Jesus said, well, whoever's not sinned, go ahead and cast the first stone. In other words, he didn't say it's wrong to stone her, but just make sure you're qualified. Anyone here hasn't sinned? If you've sinned, you're worthy of being stoned too. Anyway, he saved her life. He obviously showed that when he said to her, where are those who condemn you? She said, they're all gone. He said, well, I don't condemn you either. Go into no more. So Jesus rather extended forgiveness to capital criminals rather than executing capital punishment. But we don't have any place where he came out and said the government no longer is supposed to do that. In fact, in Romans 13, Paul specifically says that God has put the sword into the hand of the state in order to do that very thing, to enforce justice. And a sword is not a reference to putting someone behind bars. It's a reference to execution. So I think what we need to understand is this. In the Old Testament, the Jews were at once a church and a state. They were a religious body, and they were a political body. In the New Testament, the church is not a state, and the state is not a church. In the New Testament, the church is a spiritual entity, and it transcends all national boundaries. The state still wields the sword, and the church has a different mission, a mission of spreading the knowledge of God. The difference with Israel was that they were both a church and a state. As a church, they had to spread the knowledge of God. As a state, they had to enforce justice. So certain commands were given to them that apply to a state but don't apply to the church today. Do you understand that, what I'm saying? So that we don't condemn the state simply because there are times when they use violence to stop a criminal. When this guy was down there in the McDonald's down in San Diego, shooting up people, you know, what he killed, 18 people who were sitting there, an old man, a baby, and two little 10-year-old kids walking in to buy a Big Mac, and a whole bunch of other people. The guy was a maniac, and a policeman shot him. And in a sense, while none of us like to hear of anyone dying, including bad guys, I think most of us breathed a sigh of relief, said, well, praise the Lord, justice was done. This guy would have killed a million people if he was left to himself. Now, I'm glad it wasn't the church that shot him, because that's not the church's business. The church is out to redeem criminals, to redeem sinners. But the state doesn't have a ministry of redemption. It has a ministry of justice. The church is God's agent of mercy. The state is God's agent of justice. Israel was both a church and a state intermixed. Therefore, they had to extend mercy, but also justice. And that's why they had a very different set of commands given to them than are given to us. I hope that's clear. We can't go much further with it. But murder, of course, was forbidden even to the Jews. But this does not forbid, at least in the Old Testament context, it does not forbid capital punishment, war, eating meat. Those are some of the misapplications of this command that some people have made. But it's clearly saying that any malicious, hateful, vengeful killing is out of the question. And Jesus brought that out. And John 2, as in those verses we look at, said hatred and anger are the things that are just as bad as murder, because those are the motives from which actual murder springs. Okay, then we have adultery. Verse 14, you shall not commit adultery. Jesus stressed, of course, again, the spiritual side of this one, that it's not only the act, but also the motive, the lust, the desire for that person that is not yours, the unclean way of thinking about someone of the opposite sex. Now, of course, all forms of sexual uncleanness would come under the ban also, and later on in Leviticus, a whole list of sexual crimes is enumerated. Bestiality, homosexuality, incest with various individuals are detailed. All kinds of extramarital sex and abnormal sex are forbidden. And those are sort of all embodied in this one statement, thou shalt not commit adultery. Of course, this had spiritual application to the Jews also, because they were married to God and were not to commit spiritual adultery by worshiping idols. But in general, this is talking about the actual act of violating the marriage covenant. No motive is given, but we know that one of the reasons this is so wrong is because it violates a holy institution of God, which is marriage. There are three institutions that the Bible says were ordained of God. And as Jesus said about one of them, what man has joined together, what God has put together, let not man put asunder. And when God establishes an institution, it's not the purpose of God's people to break it up. And, of course, one is the church, and one is the state, and one is the family. Family is the most basic, and the most holy, perhaps. I don't know, maybe the church is more holy, I'm not sure. I suppose they're all, in a sense, have a certain holiness about them, but the state, much less, obviously. The point I'm making, though, is that marriage is a holy institution. Adultery violates that holy institution. It profanes it. It treats it as though it's nothing. It's almost like touching the mountain, treating the mountain of God like any other mountain. Now, it's interesting that in the Bible, fornication is forbidden and adultery is forbidden. By fornication, I mean sexual relations between unmarried people. We'll see it very clearly later in the next chapters. You've already read it if you've read through Exodus 23, that if a man slept with an unmarried woman who is not betrothed, he would either have to marry her or pay a dowry, a penalty, to her father. But he was not stoned to death. But if a man slept with another man's wife, he's stoned to death. Now, here are permitted. A Christian or a Jew was not permitted to go out and sleep with an unmarried person, nor with someone who is married to someone else. But interestingly, the penalty for violating the marriage covenant was greater than simply the same act when it was done with someone who wasn't married. Now, both are bad, and I'm not trying to say that fornication is a light matter. Paul said, let not fornication ever be named among you. And no Christian is supposed to do it or get involved in it at all. There's no light view taken of fornication in the Bible. But I'm simply saying, while the sexual act in itself is wrong when it is outside the confines of marriage, it is wrong in itself. There's a further wrong, an additional wrong attached to adultery, because it not only is an impure sexual act, but it's a violation of a covenant. It's breaking a covenant, the marriage covenant between two parties. By the way, let me turn your attention momentarily to 1 Thessalonians about this, because I believe that Paul sort of indicates in 1 Thessalonians 5 that even fornication with unmarried people, that is, if you're not married and you sleep with someone who's also not married, that this also is adultery in a sense. It also violates a marriage in a sense, and namely the future marriage of that person. In 1 Thessalonians 4, I said 5, but it's 4. The opening verses, Paul says, furthermore then, we beseech you, brethren, and exhort you by the Lord Jesus Christ, as you have received of us, how ye ought to walk and to please God, so ye would abound more and more. For ye know what commandments we gave you by the Lord Jesus. For this is the will of God, even your sanctification or holiness, that you should abstain from fornication, that every one of you should know how to possess his vessel or his body in sanctification and honor, not in the lust of concupiscence, even as the Gentiles who don't know God, that no man should go beyond and defraud his brother in any matter, because that the Lord is the avenger of all such, as we also have forewarned you and testified. For God has not called us to uncleanness, but unto holiness. Now, where he says in verse 6, don't go beyond and defraud his brother in any matter. Notice the word any is in italics. In the Greek it simply says in matter. And most translators, the newer translators, believe that the actual meaning is this matter. Don't defraud your brother in this matter. Now here's an interesting point. He's talking about fornication between two unmarried people. But he says, if you, sir, go and sleep with a woman who's not married, you're yet defrauding your brother in this matter, because your brother someday is maybe going to be married to her. And he has a right to have he and she both have a right to marry a virgin. Now, most people relinquish that right these days because it's hard to find a virgin anymore. But the point is, it is the man's right to say, I'm going to be giving my whole life to you. I want to think that I'm the only partner you're having too. But if you come into the marriage and there's already been sexual relations, I mean, that doesn't make it not a marriage, but it's someone has been violated. I mean, you've been ripped off. Both parties have been ripped off if someone else has already gotten to your wife, even though she wasn't your wife yet. She didn't have a right to sleep with him anyway, and he had no right to sleep with her. They were violating the laws of God. God intended her for you. That man who slept with her before you were married to her violated you. And that's what Paul seems to be saying. He seems to be talking about unmarital, premarital sex, but he says, do not defraud your brother in this matter. Well, the only sense in which I could understand that would be if he's saying, when you sleep with a woman that's not your wife, and she's not anyone else's wife, yet chances are she'll be somebody's wife someday. And by sleeping with her, you are defrauding her future husband. And, of course, you're defrauding your future wife at the same time if you're doing that. So premarital sex actually falls in an extended way in the category of adultery, because you're violating a future marriage instead of an existing one. In a sense, we could say that marriage is already existing in God's mind. He already knows that these two people are going to be married, so in his mind, they're already married. So you're violating someone else's marriage. Well, the next commandment is, thou shalt not steal. We could go into great lengths of the various ways people steal, whether it be from cheating on their income tax to stealing a person's good name, even, or by... There's just all kinds of ways people fudge on this matter. The whole purpose of this commandment is to establish the right of personal property. The Bible does not teach enforced communism. That is to say, all things are not by nature everyone else's. No one has the right to take what you've earned. That's stealing. The whole concept of stealing is only possible because God acknowledges the right to personal property. But the gospel calls us, of course, to relinquish that right and say, yes, I have the right to this property. I earned it. It is money I generated. In a sense, there's a natural human right. No one has the right to steal it from me, but I relinquish that right because I see a poor person and I'm going to give it to him anyway. See, so that we have things in all things in common, but that's voluntary. It doesn't deny the principle that we have the right to hang on to it. When Ananias and Sapphira sold their land and only gave part of it to the church, Peter said, you had the right to do what you wanted with the money, didn't you? They said, why did you deceive us about that? See, he indicated that it was not required that they sell it and give the money to them. It was their business whether they did or not. It was a voluntary act on the part of those who did it. So the gospel does not violate the concept of private property, although, of course, it transports it to a new area of stewardship. You know, what I would call my property is really God's property. But it's not my neighbor's property until God and I decide that that's who it's going to be. God tells me, give it to him, I give it to them. Then it's theirs. But thou shalt not steal is actually contrary to the communist philosophy. And I mean the heathen communists. Of course, we know there's something like communism that's Christian, and that's sharing. You know, so that he that gathered much had no extra, and he that gathered little had no lack. Well, I'm talking about the place where the state actually rips off a person. Say, you earn that money, I'm going to take it and I'm going to use it this way instead. And of course, excessive taxation may be seen as theft also. A situation where you charge excessive interest on a loan is theft. The Bible forbade the Jews to charge interest to their brothers, because usually those who borrowed money were poor. The reason they borrowed money is because they didn't have money. If you charge them interest, you're just exploiting their poverty. And that was stealing. So there's a number of ways in which stealing manifests in our lives. You can get our tape if you want to go deeper than we can go now on it. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. This is as close as we get to a statement against lying. a commandment against lying. Bearing a false witness, technically speaking, means that when you go to court, you should tell the truth and not falsely condemn a man who's innocent. You shouldn't bear witness against him if he's not guilty. But the point is here that you're supposed to tell the truth. You're supposed to be a truthful person. And of course, in a sense, whenever you tell a lie, it hurts whoever it is you're deceiving. You are bearing false witness against your neighbor. Even though it may not be a direct thing where he's going to be condemned for it because you gave a false witness in court against him, nonetheless, he's suffering by not knowing the truth. You're giving him something that's a lie. Therefore, you're ripping him off of the truth, and it's not a good thing. It's against this principle. The whole idea is that we're supposed to be entirely human. When I say human, I mean more upfront about what we're thinking. We should be entirely transparent as human beings. We should be people of integrity, honest, truthful. Those are all the, of course, that's the spiritual side of this. Just like the adultery command and the murder command had a spiritual thing behind it, so too. It's not just a matter of technically avoiding lying when you're under oath in court, but having the character that a liar has. A person who lies under oath is a person who will probably lie when he's not under oath. He's a man who's a dishonest man, and that's forbidden, being a dishonest person. Okay, now the last one is, thou shalt not covet. And it lists several things you shouldn't covet, but then it says at the end, or anything that's your neighbor. So basically, you shall not covet anything. To covet is to desire that which is not yours by right. And if it's not yours, obviously it's someone else's. And covetousness goes further than just saying, I wish I had what he has. Like if you, for instance, see your neighbor's wife and say, I wish she was my wife. Or if you see your neighbor's car and say, I wish that was my car. That's obviously coveting what belongs to your neighbor. But in a sense, if you look at something you do not yet own, even a car on a car lot, and you greedily covet it for yourself, you're still coveting something that's not yours. It belongs to the owner. Now, if he wants to barter with you, if he wants to take money from, you know, in exchange for the car, there's no problem there because it becomes rightfully yours. But the idea is where you set your affections and your lusts on things that have not been given to you and therefore are not rightfully yours. Maybe they will become yours at some point. But when you set your lusts and your affections on them, and this, of course, covetousness is essentially greed, a longing for possessions, the love of money, as John called it, or actually Paul called it. John called it the lust of the eyes. In 1 John chapter 2, he said the lust of the eyes is not of the Father, but is of the world. That means seeing something and lusting after it, desiring it for yourself. That's covetousness. It's Paul who called it the love of money. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, he said the love of money is the root of all evil. Now, that's an interesting statement, because when it gets down to it, this is the only commandment of the ten that has anything to do about the attitude. All the other commandments could be kept outwardly without a changed attitude. You could avoid worshiping idols. You could avoid working on the Sabbath. You could avoid using the name of God wrongly. You could avoid sleeping with your neighbor's wife or killing your neighbor or stealing or lying about him. You could avoid all those things without necessarily having a good attitude. Those things all could be confined to the outward, although Jesus made it clear that they have an inward quality that we have to observe also. But the covetous thing has to do with your attitude wholly and completely. No one could keep this commandment without a change of heart about possessions. It's interesting that the rich young ruler who came to Jesus said, what must I do to inherit eternal life? He said, keep the commandments. He said, which ones? He listed several. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery, you shall honor your father and mother, you shall not steal. The rich young ruler said, I've kept all those commandments from my youth. He says, but you lack one thing. Sell all you have and give it to the poor. Forgot about thou shalt not covet. Forgot about greed. And that's one commandment the man's heart rebelled against. Outward obedience to the other laws was no problem. But to have his heart weaned from the love of the world and love of money and the love of possessions was something he hadn't dealt with. And so he went away sorrowful because he had great possessions. Jesus warned very strongly against covetousness in many places. In Luke chapter 12, he said, beware of covetousness, for a man's life does not consist in the abundance of the things that he possesses. Paul said, let your conversation be without covetousness in Hebrews 13. But be content with such things as you have, for he has said, I shall never leave thee nor forsake thee. There's many places that covetousness is forbidden in the New Testament. And the interesting thing is, it's the one command of the bunch that is overtly a spiritual command. Whereas the others, like I said, could be misunderstood to just be outward. This is clearly inward. And it sort of is the capstone on the whole Decalogue. Because, as Paul said, the love of money, or covetousness, is the root of all evil. When Paul said that, he didn't mean that every evil act that was ever committed was done because someone loved money. It's obvious that many people have gone out and committed fornication without ever any thought about money. Or that they may have even killed without money as a motive. Or may have done any other kinds of act without it. But it's also true that every one of those acts have sometimes been done for that motive. What do you think prostitution's about? Those women don't do it for love of sex, that's for sure. It's for love of money. Same thing with the pornographic industry. It's not the love of sex that keeps those books published. It's the money that people make publishing them. Of course, it's the love of sex that gets people to buy them, but the whole reason they're produced is because someone loves money. Paul's statement about the love of money is the root of all evil, many modern translators have changed it, I think, to a preferable interpretation. They say the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Not that every instance or every act of evil is always motivated by the love of money, but all kinds of evil have been done for that motive. People have murdered for money. People have committed adultery for money. People have stolen for money, obviously. People have borne false witness against other people in court for money. Judges have borne false witness for money, bribes. People have dishonored their parents for money. That was the whole thing Jesus pointed out. They didn't want to help their parents financially. They wanted to hang onto it themselves, so they dishonored their parents. People have cursed God for money. They have worshipped idols for money. In fact, the worship of idols, money is an idol. Paul, twice, once in Ephesians and once in Colossians, says, avoid covetousness, which is idolatry. He equated covetousness, the love of money, with idolatry because it's giving a false value to money, which puts it on the level of a god, looking to money for the things that we should look to God for our security, for our happiness, and so forth. People look to money for that instead of looking to God. It's a god. It's idolatry. How about using the name of the Lord in vain? I believe people have sworn falsely, oaths for the sake of money, and also, of course, working on the Sabbath. People have worked on the Sabbath for money. Obviously, I mean, because they wanted more money than they could make in 6 days, they worked the seventh day. In other words, every one of the Ten Commandments, I should say of the other nine, have been violated for the love of money. So the Tenth Commandment basically says, as a capstone to all the rest, let me tell you this. The love of money is what's going to trip you up on all these things. Don't covet. Here's the heart attitude that you need in order to avoid all the rest. You need to avoid covetousness because that's the root of all kinds of evil. And you might, through covetousness, and some people have, violated any of the other nine commandments. And so we see covetousness is the root of many problems, and it is the capstone of the evils forbidden in the Ten Commandments, which is perhaps why Jesus spoke so frequently against it. It is the root of many evils in our lives too, when we begin to put a false value on money and on possessions and put them above God. Well, we're pretty much out of time, but I do want to finish the chapter real quickly. All the people saw the thunderings and the lightnings and the noise of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, and when the people saw it, they removed and stood afar off. And they said to Moses, speak thou with us, and we will hear, but let not God speak with us, lest we die. They didn't like hearing those laws. In Hebrews chapter 12, it tells us why they didn't like God to speak with them. It wasn't because only of the fact that it was a fearful thing when he was thundering out those commands and so forth, but it was actually the content of his communication they didn't like. It says in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 18 through 20, it says, for you are not come, you Christians have not come unto a mount that might be touched, and that burned with fire, and unto blackness and darkness and tempest, and the sound of a trumpet, and the voice of words, which voice they heard, they that heard entreated that the word should not be spoken to them any more, for they could not endure that which was commanded. And if so much as a beast touched the mountain, it should be stoned or thrust through with a dart. And so terrible was the sight that Moses said, I exceedingly fear and quake. Apparently Deuteronomy 9:19 is alluded to here. But the point is, he's talking about the mountain. We haven't come to that kind of a mountain. He says, they asked that the words no longer be spoken to them because they couldn't endure what was commanded. That is, they weren't just terrified of the loud noise and the earthquakes and the clouds and the lightning. They were terrified when they heard what it was God required. Yes. Hebrews 12, 18 through 20. When they heard the Ten Commandments, they said, wow, that's heavy. How can we do that? And they couldn't endure the thing that was commanded. So they said, God, don't talk to us anymore. If you want to talk to Moses, that's okay. We'll listen to whatever he says, but we don't want to hear you anymore. And a lot of people have had that attitude too. Let the preacher talk to me. I don't want to hear from God. I've heard people say, I'd rather see the devil than see God. I've heard Christians say that because they say, I'd be afraid to see God. But, you know, we should be drawn to God. We should savor communion with God. We should desire to hear his voice and to have him speak to us. But many people, because of their sins and their unwillingness to obey what it is that they're afraid God is going to say, they avoid fellowship with God. They don't want to get alone with God and be quiet with the Lord and have communion with God. They're too much afraid that he's going to ask them to do something they don't want to do. And that's a horrible thing. When our hearts are right before God and we realize that all that he would request is best for us, and we're more than willing to do it, then we long to hear him speak to us. We long to have fellowship with him. And those who have a right heart will always do so. In verse 20 says, Moses said unto the people, fear not, for God has come to test you, and that his fear may be before your faces, that you sin not. And the people stood afar off, and Moses drew near unto the thick darkness where God was. Then the Lord said unto Moses, thus thou shalt say unto the children of Israel, ye have seen that I have talked with you from heaven. Ye shall not make with me gods of silver, neither shalt ye make you gods of gold. An altar of earth thou shalt make unto me, and shalt sacrifice thereon thy burnt offerings, and thy peace offerings, thy sheep and thine oxen. In all the places where I record my name, I will come unto thee, and I will bless thee. And if thou wilt make me an altar out of stone, thou shalt not build it of hewn stone, for if thou lift a tool upon it, you have polluted it. Neither shalt thou go up by steps unto my altar, that thy nakedness be not discovered thereon. Now on the same occasion, a little later, God gave them plans for the golden altar and the brazen altar that became part of the worship of the tabernacle. But here he's talking about other altars besides that. When you offer a sacrifice to God out on a mountainside or something, or out in the woods, like Abraham did and Isaac did, wherever God led them, they built an altar to consecrate the place to the Lord. It says, don't make it out of stones. Make it out of earth. Or if you have to use stones because the earth around is unsuitable and you have stones available, then make it with stones, but don't carve the stones at all. You'll pollute it as soon as you hit it with a chisel. And what he means by that is, as soon as you start to ornament and adorn the altar, you begin to make it sort of an attraction in itself. You sort of make the altar an object of worship. This would be the same thing as forbidding ornate buildings and so forth to worship God in, because they draw attention to themselves instead of to God. The idea of an altar is that you're looking to God, but as soon as you start to decorate the altar, you're suddenly giving too much attention to the altar. And when you begin to fill the church with all kinds of decorative things that people say, oh, isn't that beautiful stained glass? Isn't that a beautiful bit of furniture up there? Isn't that a beautiful choir loft? Or look at that beautiful picture behind the baptistry. Begin to decorate it. Then, of course, you're drawing attention to that instead of to God. And he said, let's keep it plain. If you're going to make an altar to me, the idea is to pay attention to me. Therefore, don't defile it by beginning to carve images. And of course, you could even get close to carving little idols and things, as the heathen did. They had carved images.